Shale, summer's over.
Alan, it's the middle of August. Tell me why you think summer is over.
Well, even at the beginning of August, summer is already over. You can feel the change. Like, you can feel the sunlight's different. The sunrise and sunset starts to change. You can just tell that it's over.
I don't know, man. By your definition, like, the height of summer is the first day of summer.
No, the height of summer is July. Oh, sorry. You mean like, yeah, in terms of the...
Like the sunlight and stuff like that. Because the solstice.
Sorry, the solstice, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because the solstice is June 21st, and that's the first day of summer, and that's the longest day of the year. So,
right, but I don't really notice. Maybe it's because, like, where we live, the sun rises so much earlier than most people get up, and it sets quite late. I don't really notice the change in the sunrise until August. Like, right. Come August, like, it's not fully bright out when I wake up some mornings. So,
yeah, I mean, I feel that. But it still feels like summer to me. It's still warm. It's still, I don't know. It still stays light out fairly late.
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, the actual
by September,
reason...
though, by September, I agree. Like, you know, right. By September, it's starting to feel like, okay, summer's wrapping up.
I don't actually have like a astronomical argument for summer being over, but I go back to work this week. That's why I actually feel like
yeah. Ah, there's the rub. Mm. So Alan's summer is over, therefore everyone's summer is over.
if I can't have it, no one can. Close the ice cream shops, close the beaches, right. The spray decks, the public
no more
pools,
fishing anyone. All your boat off the lake. Let's get back to work.
Make sure to drain and dry it so that you don't transport zebra mussels. Welcome to Food Court. My name is Alan Suddaby, and I'm here with my buddy, Shale McDonald. Hi, Shale.
Hey, Alan.
We're two chefs from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food and we love to talk about it.
Sure do.
What a train wreck.
It's totally reasonable.
Short and sweet. Our cold opens are just so long sometimes.
Oh yeah, that no, one, I like that. I that like one. That cold open was like perfect. Mm. It was such a cute little one. And I didn't even have to ask you what you had for lunch.
Yeah, exactly. I have some ideas for like slightly more structured ones where like you pick a number between 1 and 1,000 and then we like open La Russe Gastronomique to that page and we see if we, I don't know,
yeah,
if we know what the word is. But
it's a good idea for a cold open. It's also a good idea for a segment on the podcast. We should do that sometime.
Do you want to try it right now?
Yeah, you got the La Russe?
Yeah. Is it, like, because I have it in front of me, is it just, like, I'm giving you a term and you're going to define it for me? Is that what's happening? Or
yeah, I'll let you know what if I've heard of it or what the deal is. Or like, I'll name a page number. You tell me what recipe is on that page, and I'll tell you if I know how to make it.
Okay. So pick a number between 1 and, well, first of all, guess how many pages there are in La Russe.
850.
You're going to pick a number between 1 and 1,310.
Whoa. Holy smokes. I was short by 500 pages. I was short by a whole Stephen King novel.
That'd be a short King novel, wouldn't it?
That would be. Yeah. That's fair.
It'd be one of his novellas, I think.
Yeah. I think there are quite a few books of his that are like less than 500 pages, like the ones that are similar to like Misery and stuff. Mm-hmm. Okay, Alan, what's on page 666?
Oh my God.
I know, Shale's so boring.
This is the lamb section, the entry for
lamb section. Okay. Of course it is.
Okay. We'll see how.
It's not actually a recipe on this page.
Well, I mean, like a lot of the, there's several right. lamb recipes in this section. So I'm not going to ask you how to make roast loin of lamb because I think that's...
I do know how to make...
lamb cutlets du Berry.
Du Berry. Hmm.
Do you remember that term?
I've heard the term. It definitely sounds familiar, but I can't off the top of my head remember what it entails. That's sad.
It always signifies the use of cauliflower.
Oh, really?
And so actually this is just like grilled or sauteed lamb rib chops that are served basically with cauliflower gratin, like cauliflower with mornay and gratin.
Oh, nice.
Sounds nice.
Yeah. Sounds American. Okay. Well,
moving on.
Maybe next time that segment will be more interesting. Do we have any follow-up? Do we have any follow-up? Alan, do you have any follow-up?
BA's rhubarb coffee cake?
Ah, yes. Excellent.
Is that how it's referred to?
Sure, yeah. Yeah. BA's rhubarb coffee cake. Yeah, that's, I would say, the perfect encapsulation of its
identity.
I can't
even remember why we were talking about it.
I don't exactly remember either.
Something about cake
just because
soaked
I'm
in
obsessed
syrup.
With it, and she made some, I mm-hmm. think.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Shale delivered a container of, sorry, BA is Betty Ann, that's Shale's mom.
That's
and
right.
And she makes a really killer rhubarb coffee cake, and Shale has been gushing about it ceaselessly.
All over the podcast.
seemingly in every episode. That's what it feels like anyways. Yeah. And she made some last week, and Shale delivered it to my door, and everyone in my family tasted it, and we all agree, delicious.
It's quite delicious.
It's really good. The cake, so yeah. It's like a cake base, and then... kind of like a stewed rhubarb layer. And then is it like, what would you call it? Is the top streusel or what would you say?
Yeah, I would say it's streusel. Yeah. Yeah.
So the cake, I followed her retherming instructions, briefly microwaved. Mm-hmm.
Those were actually my retherming instructions.
Okay.
Just, yeah. She didn't actually say to do that. But I thought since, like, I don't know, it's just... always slightly more tender if it's a little bit warm.
And, yeah, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
The cake, very moist, very tender, very buttery, delicious. Actually, the salt content was pretty good too, I thought.
Yeah.
The tartness of the rhubarb layer, perfect balance. The streusel, can't get enough. What more can I say, Shale?
Yeah.
It's good
it's
with
such
ice cream.
A great cake.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, no worries. I don't.
Seems like a good kind of like framework that you could like rhubarb is like I love rhubarb more than anyone, but like you could probably make that with sour cherries or any number of things, right?
Yeah, exactly. Sour cherries would work great. I think like sort of the key to it is like it's quite rich and moist, but yeah, having the acidity of the rhubarb and it like the rhubarb isn't totally unsweetened. But it's mm-hmm. definitely not sweetened to the point where, you know, like it's just another sweet component. It definitely helps balance the cake. Mm-hmm. And then also there's quite a bit of it in that layer. And so it really helps keep things moist and stuff too. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's great.
So yeah, any
one of
like
my faves.
Tart, like don't worry, don't bother with apples, but like you could do interesting things like with Hascaps or something
like
that.
Oh yeah. Man. Yeah, that would be great. Hascaps would be great. Sour cherries would be great. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe apricots.
Oh, man. Yeah. Or plums.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I also have a piece of follow-up.
Mm-hmm.
So on the last episode, our cold open was like 20 minutes of discourse about Mapo tofu.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah.
Or at least, at the very least, we started by talking about Mapo tofu, mm-hmm. Which at the time, I didn't really know what it was. I have seen that dish before. I've seen it made, but I didn't know what it was called, and I didn't really understand how, like, crazy popular and, mm-hmm. like, how prevalent it is.
Yeah.
And you were gracious enough to school me on it a little bit. But then I went and did a whole bunch of research about it after the fact. Mm-hmm. And then also listener Millie messaged me on Instagram and said that it was one of her favorite dishes from when she was a kid and that her dad used to make it all the time.
Oh, really?
And, yeah. And that really, like, I don't know, hit me in the feels. And I thought that that was pretty cool. And so I got sort of obsessed by it. And I went out and did some grocery shopping and I bought a bunch of ingredients and watched a whole bunch of YouTube videos on how to make it. Mm-hmm. Tried to find what I thought was something that was reasonably authentic. And I think the best thing that I found was, what's the name of that channel, Alan?
Chinese Cooking Demystified.
Yeah, Chinese Cooking Demystified.
I love that channel.
Yeah, so it's a Chinese woman, and she does most of the actual cooking on the channel, I think. Mm-hmm. And her husband, I guess, is American, and he now lives with her in China, and he sort of narrates. I mean, she speaks perfectly good English, but I think that, you know, since she's doing the cooking, it's easier for him to do some of the narration. Mm-hmm. I think maybe I've seen a couple of their videos where she does part of the narration as well.
Yes, and some where he does the cooking. Yeah.
Oh, right.
And okay. He usually points out all of the errors that he's making in the narration that he dubs later. Yeah.
But yeah, so they actually have a couple of videos regarding Mapo Tofu, and I watched them both. Or maybe they have more than a couple, but I watched two of them, I think, and a couple others. I also watched Kenji's, which was, I don't know, his version is kind of like, what's the word? Like deauthentified or something.
Right. Like it's his Japanese mother's version of it, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it's, and there is like a straight up, like there are Korean versions of it, Japanese versions of it, you know, like there's a bunch of, like the dish has gone all over Asia, mm-hmm. and is made in a bunch of different ways in those different places. And all of those, you know, all of those incarnations are also authentic to their own region or whatever. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Kenji's version was, sort of like his childhood version. And it's not strictly the like authentic Japanese version either. It's sort of like, I guess like a slightly westernized version of it. Mm-hmm. But anyways, yeah, I made it. I thought it turned out great. My parents came over and had lunch, and me and my sister and my parents all had it together and mm-hmm. really enjoyed it. I made it not too spicy because the rest of the fam, I think, would have found that off-putting.
Right, yeah.
So it was like very mildly spicy, but had quite a bit of numbing, like Szechuan peppercorn in it. Mm-hmm. And yeah, everyone really loved it. I really loved it. But now I kind of feel like I'm in the same boat as you before we talked about it last week, wherein like I don't really know how close to something authentic my version is. Mm-hmm. And I really need to be able to either try a version that I know is authentic or you know, get someone who has tasted a bunch of authentic versions of it to taste it and let me know like what I should be doing in terms of the balance and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I do think that, like, you know, after watching a whole bunch of videos about it, like one of the sort of I guess the impression that I get is that, I mean, although you can order it in, you know, Szechuan restaurants, I'm sure it, I feel like from what I like the vibe that I was getting from watching all of the YouTube videos is that it tends to be more of like an at-home dish.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that like everyone sort of has their own version, and every video that I watched, just about everyone in it says things like, if you don't want it as spicy, you don't have to put in this much spice. Or, you know, right. Like it seems like it's very malleable, mm-hmm. in terms of like what is acceptable to be able to, you know, like call Mapo Tofu.
Right.
And definitely the version that I made was really well balanced, I thought, for my palate, and delicious. So I feel like I got pretty close.
Yeah. Cool.
Anyways, I'm hoping Millie will taste mine at some point.
Cool.
And let me know how it stacks up. I guess we'll see. I'm also curious, like, the next time that I make it, whether it will be close to the same or not. Like, I was pretty rough on measurements while I was making it, so it might be kind of tricky to replicate it, but yeah. Anyway, that was exciting. I got obsessed by Mapo Tofu.
Yeah.
And made some, and I plan on making a bunch more.
Awesome.
Word.
One funny side note on the, okay, so for me, the two sources that I consulted when I first tried making it at home, the first one, there's a blog called Walks of Life, Walks spelled W-O-K-S. It's, I think it's an American family. I don't know if the parents of the family are maybe first generation American, but they're of Chinese descent. And they tend to have really, I've used a few of their recipes and thought they were really great. So I went there for Mapo Tofu and then, yeah, Chinese cooking demystified. I feel like, and this is just kind of like a theory, I feel like some of the specific things they say in the Chinese cooking demystified video are specifically targeted at the Walks of Life blog post on Mapo Tofu.
Oh, really?
Like, kind of throwing shade. The two things that come to mind were, one is that the Walks of Life recipe calls for silken tofu, which I used the first time that I made it, and it just like disintegrated in the pan. Like, you just stir it and then everything breaks apart. And so I think a few times in the Chinese cooking demystified video, do not use silken tofu because then you'll make tofu mush bowl or whatever, not mapo tofu.
Yeah, exactly.
Use firm tofu. Use soft tofu.
Right.
And then the other one was, he goes out of his way to say that he doesn't put ginger in his mapo tofu because it should be the mala flavor profile. And the Walks of Life recipe is quite strong with ginger. And maybe it's a coincidence, or maybe there's a whole bunch of different prominent sources that call for silken tofu and ginger, but I just thought it was funny that it seemed like the two that I consulted, one was
sort of had differing opinions on what and
kind of knew
or
they knew of each other's positions and stuff. I don't know.
Right. That's interesting because, well, there's no way to stop me from going down this rabbit hole, so I don't even know why I'm questioning whether I should or not, because there's no way that I'm not going to talk about this now. But in Kenji's video, he said something really interesting, which I didn't see in any of the other videos. But he's extremely knowledgeable. And so I haven't followed up about this, but when he said it, I was like, oh, like, that actually kind of makes sense. And I'm surprised that I haven't heard this before. And that is that you can get, like, he says that most, like, grocery store tofu, like in North America, if you buy silken, you're buying, like, you know, extremely soft but very smooth tofu. But what Kenji says is that there's actually like two sort of styles of tofu, depending on what they use to coagulate the proteins.
Okay.
And one of those styles is silken and one is like something else, but he said it's like kind of more spongy or web-like, right? And definitely I've had tofu that is both of those ways, but he said that you can get differing like densities of silken tofu and different densities of the other variety. And
in North America, he said,
in North America, like, if you know what you're looking for. I don't know if it's available always in every grocery store, but the tofu that he had was like silken texture but firm density.
I see. Yeah.
And he said that, like, you know, for his, you know, for what his mom used to make, that's like sort of the more authentic. But every, like, every other recipe that I've seen basically says to use soft.
Yes.
And not silken, with the exception of the one that you just brought up.
Right.
Which is what I used. But the soft tofu that I bought was definitely not like the sort of more like web-like texture.
Mm-hmm.
It was definitely like the very, like extremely smooth textured soft tofu.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of important, is that you want the really smooth tofu and not the stuff that's kind of like more spongy.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess I need to do a little more research on that, because that was like the first time, like when Kenji said that was the first time that I had ever heard that. Mm-hmm. And I've used quite a bit of tofu. I've bought quite a bit of tofu, and I wasn't really aware of that distinction. And so I definitely need to do a little more research and maybe try a couple different styles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I'll let you know.
Okay.
Well, there'll be follow-up to my follow-up.
Report back. Meta follow-up.
So what are we going to talk about tonight, Alan?
Apparently we're talking about a TV show called The Bear.
That's right.
Sorry.
More Siskel and Ebert.
Apparently we're talking about a radio station called 100.3 The Bear. So I've been listening to it all week to prep for this.
Man, I would object to this joke, but I know that all of our listeners are Edmontonians. So.
So yeah, I know all the lyrics to every Green Day song, Tea Party song.
Party, wow. Yeah. Haven't thought about that band in a long time.
All those rock stations, like what used to be modern rock or alternative rock, like those are now just the oldies stations, because they're still playing stuff from the 90s and it's 30 years old. Sorry, we don't have to talk about that. Today we're talking about a TV show called The Bear.
Yeah. So, what is this TV show, Alan?
The premise is, it's a TV show about a chef. That's why we're talking about it. And the premise is that a chef who has worked in some of the most prestigious restaurants in the United States returns to run a restaurant that after the death of his brother. So he returns to his home of Chicago because his brother, who was operating a Italian beef sandwich shop there, has died. That's the setup.
That's the premise. Yeah. And how did you hear about this show?
You told me that we're doing an episode on it. So I'm just kidding.
So you heard about it from me?
No, I did.
Or had you heard about it before?
I think I saw someone post about it on Instagram.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I think that might be what happened to me too.
It was Spencer.
Spencer
posted about it. When it went on Disney Plus or whatever, Spencer posted, finally. And there was like a screenshot of it. And I was like, I don't know what that is. So I looked into it. So it's all Spencer's fault. Yeah.
Well, thank you, listener Spencer. So the first three episodes of it are on Disney Plus. I don't know for sure if they plan to add the rest or whether it's just sort of like they put the, because it's, it actually is made by FX and airs on FX in the States, or I assume also in Canada. And FX is owned by Fox and like 20th Century Fox, and Disney now owns them. Right. So Disney owns FX. And I wonder if like them putting the first three episodes on Disney Plus is basically just like a strategy to drive traffic to watch the show on FX or on FX's streaming service or something like that. I'm not quite sure what's happening there.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know.
So I'm not sure if the rest of the episodes are ever going to make their way to Disney Plus. I hope that they do.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, right now, as we record this, only the first three episodes are available on Disney Plus.
Right.
And so if you have Disney Plus, you can go check them out. I would probably recommend checking them out before listening to what we're about to talk about, because it's going to be pretty much meaningless unless you have watched the show. Unless hearing us talk about it gets you excited to watch it or something. Right. But right. I guess we'll find out. So we're just going to discuss those first three episodes for now, but then potentially maybe down the road we'll talk about the rest of the season or something. I think for both of us, we've only watched the first three. Is that right, Alan?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I've only watched the first three and Alan's only watched the first three. So that's what we're going to talk about tonight and talk about, I guess, what we thought of it and whether we liked it and whether we want to watch more of it and whether we want to maybe talk about it again once we have done that.
Deal.
Right on. So should we just start by talking? Let's talk about the episodes in succession, I guess, right? We can just talk about the first episode first and then...
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Makes sense to me.
Okay. So I actually watched the first two episodes yesterday, but you had kind of watched them, a week ago or a couple weeks ago or something?
Yeah, I don't know, maybe two or 3 weeks ago, yeah.
Yeah. And just what was your first impression when you watched the first episode?
It was good. I liked it. The what it does really well is kind of like, I can't say that, you know, every kitchen is different. And I hate when people say, oh, well, that's not a realistic kitchen because every kitchen is, or whatever. That's not a realistic whatever.
Right.
But regardless of like whether you think that the portrayal is like a realistic depiction of a kitchen in chaos with severe management issues and stuff, what it does really well is like the subjective feeling of like anxiety and chaos going into a busy service when you're a bit disorganized. It nails that. You could argue maybe it's a little bit over the top, but like the feeling of that anxiety associated with service when that kind of chaos and kind of toxic management is present, it nails that. Like that's exactly what it feels like or can feel like. It's kind of like the opening of the D-Day invasion in Saving Private Ryan. Like people, you can quibble about whether or not that was like what it really looked like and whether that it was really that's how it went down. But like the subjective experience of the people trying to strike the beaches, like it nailed that.
Yeah. I mean, like it definitely nailed like the horror and like total like chaos and of what a situation like that must be like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously I have no exposure to any situation like that, but it definitely made me never want to be in any situation like that.
Right. Yeah.
And I feel the same way about the first episode of The Bear. Like I definitely think that it was over the top, like too much.
Yeah. Yes.
Like so much yelling.
Yeah.
And like, the show opens directly into this situation where, you know, like you're just in this kitchen with a bunch of characters that you don't know. I guess like you do get introduced to the chef first. His name is Carmine, right?
Yeah.
You sort of like see him working on something, and then the next character that comes in is who is going to wind up being the sous chef. Her name is Sydney, and she hands him a resume.
Mm-hmm.
She's there. She had already talked to him. He knows that she's coming, but he's forgotten. And she walks in and gives him a resume, and he's like, oh, yeah, right. I remember.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, her resume is full of like the best restaurants in Chicago. And he asks her, like, why are you here at this sandwich shop? Like when you have all these crazy, amazing restaurants on your resume.
Mm-hmm.
And her response is kind of like, oh, well, this was my dad's favorite place or something. And I
But then she also reveals that she knows a bit about Carmine's past, and she knows this kind of sets the scene for the slow discovery of Carmine's CV, basically.
Right.
You know that she's there because she says that he's the best chef de cuisine at the best restaurant in the United States of America, which I assume means 11 Madison Park, but I don't actually Because
we'll actually say that.
Well, yeah. We'll talk about that. Because in episode two, there's something that strongly suggests that that's what it is. But anyways, so she reveals that he's has some fantastic work experiences and is very talented. And then throughout the episode, you get these other kind of like little sneak peeks at his past, like that, for instance, right. He was nominated for a James Beard or perhaps won a James Beard Award for like a rising star chef or something like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's kind of funny too, because like she comes in and he's like, why are you here? Like, mm-hmm. you know, what made you come and apply here? And she's basically like, well, because you're here.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, like the thing about it being her dad's favorite spot or something is like, I think a little bit of a, you know,
she made it up.
It's like, so, yeah, maybe not made it up. Like maybe she had been there before. Like maybe her dad really did like it, but it's just sort of like this thing that she had in her back pocket as an answer if he asked her that.
Right.
But the real reason that she gives is that he's there. Right. But then she kind of flips it on him and she's like, why are you here?
Like, right. Yeah.
And then he has to, and then, you know, it gets a little awkward for a second. And then he's just like, I'm just making sandwiches. And then we move into like the crazy chaotic service portion of it. Right. Wherein you can tell that he has only been there for like maybe a couple of weeks or something. And he's trying to sort of like get things under control. A friend of his brother who had also been working there, it has kind of, I guess, sort of been one of the kitchen managers or something, or one of the managers of the shop.
Yeah. Is it not his cousin, or are they using cousin in a,
I think he's not actually his cousin.
Okay.
Yeah. I think he says that he was just friends with his brother in the second episode or something like that. But yeah. They call each other cousin.
Right.
I don't really understand that. Maybe it's a Chicago thing. Maybe it's an Italian thing. I'm not quite sure. Mm.
But yeah, there's a lot of animosity between them, and it's basically a power struggle where, that character is Richie, I think, right?
Richie, right. Yeah. I keep forgetting his name.
So Richie has basically,
in all of the notes that I made, I referred to him as cousin because I could never remember his name when I went to make a note. So
Richie, I'll be calling him
cousin throughout the, throughout the rest of this discussion.
Richie knows how the restaurant has been operating for the last several years, and they have a way of doing things, and it's not always the most efficient, and it doesn't always yield the best product, but he and most of the rest of the crew are very set in their ways. And I'm going to call him Carmi now, cause that's what they call him in the Carmine. They call him Carmi though.
Carmi
comes in, and especially once he has Sydney, who's like a CIA graduate and has worked at fancy restaurants, especially when she's by his side, he really tries to implement more logical structure. They do the brigade system, I think, in a later episode, right?
Yeah, that's the third episode.
But just like trying to introduce proper technique and sanitation and stuff like that. And meets with a lot of resistance from the kitchen crew at the start, but the kind of like arc of the first episode is that at the end of the first episode, he really gets through to one of the other cooks there, the baker actually, right?
Yeah. Which I like, there was a lot about the first episode that I found really worrisome.
Okay.
And we can get into that. But that was the one thing in the episode. Well, there were a couple things. One of my favorite things from the first episode was Sydney. Like, I thought that even though she's not in it a ton, mm-hmm. she's not really all that active in the first episode. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, I could sort of tell right away that I was going to like her character. She mm-hmm. just, I don't know. She seems like the kind of foil for all the madness that's going on.
Yes.
And just seemed very grounded to me. And that was like, I found that, you know, very soothing.
Yes.
I guess. Yeah. But that to me was like the, I don't know, like, I don't know what it's like to write an episode of TV, but to me, like, that seemed like the point of the first episode was like this moment where one of the cooks who's there being resistant to having this, you know, new potential boss come in and change how they're doing everything, and, you know, and no one wants to change, and and even that baker, like, they sort of set it up really well too, like at the beginning of the episode, Carmi asks the baker to make extra bread because they want to do this big service. They're planning this event. The restaurant's really short on funds. They're having trouble paying suppliers. They're having trouble paying their staff. And so Carmi wants to fix this problem by planning this event and getting a whole bunch of people to come down. So he asks the baker to bake like 2 rounds of bread instead of one.
Mm-hmm.
And then the baker is like complaining and saying that the mixer isn't working properly and that it's going to be really hard to make this extra bread. And then some bread at some point gets made and Carmi tastes it and he's like, oh, it's dry and crumbly. It's not, we need to remake this. We can't be serving our sandwiches on this like crumbly bread.
Mm.
And the baker's like, it's the mixer. Told you there's nothing I can do. You know, the bread's just going to be bad until we can fix the mixer or get a new mixer.
Right.
And Carmi's kind of like, no, it's not the mixer. It's the oven. The oven's too dry. You need to put a pan of water in the bottom of the oven. Just bake another round. And so he does that. And then at the end, the bread turns out great. And then the baker's kind of like, oh, maybe this guy does kind of know what he's doing.
Right.
There are some other things that happen during the episode to sort of lead him down that path.
Mm-hmm.
Like he finds... one of the places that Carmi has worked is Noma.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, Richie, cousin? Yeah. At some point, Richie grabs the Noma book and throws it on the floor because he's like, you know, trying because, to call you know, out
as
Carmi.
You do. I'm just kidding.
Yeah, exactly. And the baker comes by and sees it on the floor and picks it up and then sort of starts leafing through it. And there's a bunch of sort of like Carmi's credentials in there. He like keeps them pressed between the pages of the Noma book.
That's where the James Beard invite is.
Yeah, he sees this James Beard award. And so that's one of the things that kind of like leads him down the path to like being interested in what Carmi kind of has to offer or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But then by the end of the episode, he really, like, you know, Carmi comes, sees the bread is wrong, immediately diagnoses the problem, tells the baker what to do. The baker is skeptical. He does it. It turns out great. And then the baker is like, okay. Like,
and actually, there's a nice little ending to that arc where one of the things that Carmi is instituting in the kitchen is that everybody's called chef now. Which everyone thinks is pretty hilarious. Like, I'm not a chef, whatever. And people are reluctant to even use the word. But then right at the end of the episode, the baker says something like, he just says like, heard chef to Carmi. And so that was like his acknowledgement of like, perhaps even the first time that he refers to him as chef. I'm not sure, but that was like you could see in Carmi's face that like, yes, okay. We are now on the same page.
I kind of got through to this guy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought that was a really good sort of real moment.
Mm-hmm.
It sort of seemed like that's what the episode was centered around. Well, and it sort of seems like kind of that's what the arc of the season might be centered around. Obviously, I don't really know that yet, but part of the arc of the season, I think, is going to be, you know, like Carmi's journey to sort of like convince everyone that he's not a fraud or something.
Right. But, yeah.
Yeah.
It's funny. I know you and I have talked about, I don't think it's on a recording though, but like the difference between like starting a new kitchen team with a restaurant open versus coming in as chef to an existing crew. I haven't really done that, the second one. But I know that you did, like at Wilfred's and maybe other places too.
Yeah.
And it just seems like such a completely different ball of wax and like so many personal management, like personality management and stuff like that. It seems like really daunting to me.
it's very tricky. And it was, like, for me, very tricky when I started at Wilfred's because, mm-hmm. yeah, that's exactly what the situation was like.
It was just like the first episode of The Bear. Oh, my God. I'm scared.
I mean, the kitchen was not that chaotic.
Of course.
And, you know, they did have pretty good systems. I think that, you know, the chef that was there previously had a really strong, like, idea of how he wanted things to be. Mm-hmm. And it was, like, a good vision, but, it, like, there were things that just weren't working. But yeah, it was really tough and pretty awkward because the original, like, they hadn't been open all that long when I started. I think they had only been open for something like a year or mm-hmm. something like that. And the original chef had hired all of the cooks. A lot of them were kind of like friends with the original chef. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, when the original chef left and I came in, it was exactly like that. You know, like I really had to win everyone over. And that's, yeah. And how you win people over is different for every single person.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
And so it is really like a tricky balance. I mean, you know, like the reality of it is that you just go in and do your job every day and try and do a good job and try and manage people in a way that helps make their job more enjoyable and easier and better. Mm-hmm. You know, but it's like a long haul and, you know, some people, you know, give you the benefit of the doubt and some people really don't. And, you know, just, yeah. So yeah, I could definitely relate. Some of my like reservations about the show when I started watching the first episode was mm-hmm. that like, because the chaos in the kitchen is like so loud and so intense and stuff, I really was pretty worried that like the show was maybe trying to capitalize on like toxic kitchen culture, mm-hmm. you know? And that's the type of like thing that I don't know, that I'm just not a fan of anymore.
Right.
It's easy to capitalize on because it's fun to watch that, you know, like,
right.
You know, it's fun to watch people yelling mean things at other people. And, you know, like, mm-hmm. like the whole Gordon Ramsay thing, you know,
yeah.
like
yeah.
the whole Hell's Kitchen thing is obviously popular because, you know, it's, I guess, fun to watch or, you know, I don't know. I guess it was fun to watch for me the first few seasons when I watched it, but it was also like really stressful to watch. I don't know.
Right.
But I guess like the point I'm trying to make is that I feel like it's really easy to capitalize on that. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what people expect. And a lot of people sort of because of Gordon Ramsay and a lot of other things and because of actual toxic kitchen culture, you know, a lot of people think that that's how kitchens are. And, you know, and it's just like sort of an easy play to make your show about like how toxic kitchens can be and how rough it can be. And mm-hmm. and so I was a little worried that that was sort of like the direction that the show was going in.
Right.
But as much as like they're not really shying away from that, I sort of feel like it's the opposite after watching the second and third episode. Mm-hmm. Like it feels more like they're trying to say something about how that isn't okay or something.
Right. Well, I think especially, yeah. and I might be jumping ahead, I can't keep all the episodes separate, but like it looks like they're going to be taking on Carmi's mental health and addiction issues head on. Like he, mm-hmm. I can't remember if it's in the second, actually it's in the third episode. It's at the end of the second episode is when Carmi seeks out help and I think goes to an Alcoholics Anonymous anonymous meeting.
Well, actually it's not an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that he goes to, and I don't think that they ever show him drinking.
Well, I was gonna say, so they call it Al-Anon. I assumed that was short for is that not what that is?
No, Al-Anon is a different organization.
Oh, okay.
Al-Anon is like a different self-help group and it's for the families of people who have problems with addiction.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, he's just there because his brother was maybe an alcoholic or an addict. And that, I think, is sort of what's going on between he and his sister. It seems like he and his sister, they sort of like, they introduce his sister in the first episode. And it seems like they have like, maybe not a contentious relationship, but like they're definitely pretty distant.
Yes.
And Carmi sort of like keeps her at a distance by being a, you know, by being a bit of a workaholic or something like that. And so I think that sort of like the, what they're setting up in terms of like maybe kind of why their relationship is sort of distant like that is because they both maybe, you know, like have been dealing with their brother's addiction sort of in different ways. And maybe, you know, there's some like a little bit of like blame going on there, like unintention, like subconsciously or something like that.
Right.
But yeah, I think that I don't think so far I've seen anything that makes it look like they're trying to show that Carmi actually has like any kind of addiction.
No. And that's actually like, I had never heard of Al-Anon. I just assumed that it was short for Alcoholics Anonymous. But, and I was going to remark that like there's scenes of Carmi like crashing at home after work. And he's like on the couches and he's never drinking. So that was a disconnect for me, but I just didn't understand. Now I do. Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, no worries. I was a little concerned that the show was going to be sort of like capitalizing on toxic kitchen culture because, you know, it's fun to watch people yelling at each other or something like that, but it definitely doesn't seem like that's the case. And yeah, definitely it seems like they're leaning more into the potential mental health effects of that. And like, maybe it looks like they're like, it's looking to me maybe like, Carmi is suffering some PTSD from some of his like toxic kitchen like experiences or something like that. They haven't really come out and said that yet, but he's definitely like having some anxiety attacks and things like that. It's sort of like it, you know, like in the first three episodes, it's sort of like, you know, is that because of his, you know, previous kitchen experiences, or is it because his brother just died, or you know what, you know, kind of what's going on isn't really fully explained yet, but that sort of seems like something that they're trying to address in the show, which is good. And in the first episode I was definitely a little worried that wasn't the direction that they were going in.
Right. That's probably as good a segue as any into the second episode, because no, it's not.
No, it is. I shouldn't have interrupted you, but never interrupt anyone in the middle of a segue, Shale. Okay. But there was one other thing that I wanted to say about the first episode, and that's that the very, very opening of the first episode is like a stress dream, I guess, that Carmi is having. And he's like standing on the middle of a bridge in Chicago, and he like walks up to this cage and opens a cage, and a bear walks out of the cage, like a huge grizzly bear.
Yeah.
And then he kind of like wakes up. I don't know if he wakes up in the restaurant. Maybe he does wake up in the restaurant. I can't quite remember. But yeah, I found that kind of interesting too. Like they haven't really gone back to that at all. There have been a few stress dream type of situations, but like they haven't made any additional reference to the bear thing yet. So
there is one subtle one. His sister calls him Bear.
Oh, calls him Bear. Yeah. His nickname is Bear. Right. So yeah, that's definitely a thing. But yeah, not quite sure what's going on with that. But when I watched it, I was like, oh, yeah, like stress dreams. That's definitely real.
Right.
But I was kind of like, oh, well, you know, like in my work-induced stress dreams, there's always something work-related.
Yes.
Yeah, so I was a little surprised that they didn't like, you know, have the bear like blocking, like standing in the way of like a piece of meat that he needed to get to prepare for service or something, or he had to
very shortly after that. So like very early on in the first episode, there's a meat vendor who shows up, and Carmi had ordered 200 pounds of beef and they're delivering 25 pounds of beef, that's my stress stream. Like, those are the kinds of stress streams that I have. Like,
I hear you. Exactly. Yeah. Well, or it's like something ridiculous. Like, I don't really want to get into it, but I've had stress streams where like the kitchen is on like one side of a valley and the bill printer is on the other side of the valley.
Right.
And every time a bill comes up, I have to run down the hill and up the other side of the hill and get the bill off the printer and then run back to the kitchen. I've literally had that dream. Mm-hmm. So anyway, maybe that's a good segue into talking about the second episode, because doesn't the second episode start with a stress dream? Oh, no,
it starts with a flashback.
And this is, starts with a flashback.
This to me is the one that makes me think it might actually be 11 Madison Park that he worked. But it's a flashback. It starts with a title card that says New York 1 year ago. Carmi is working the pass at the kitchen is like glowing white and pristine. And there's a swarm of chefs in toques working behind him. And he's plating and working the pass and calling out bill times and things like that. And there's a cook who keeps bringing him a sauce to plate, but it's broken. So he sends it back and she comes back and it's still broken. So he sends it back. And then there's presumably the chef de cuisine. I don't know. Someone who Carmi reports to shows up.
Well, I think Carmi is the chef de cuisine.
So then who's that?
If you follow the dialogue. I don't know. Maybe the exec? I don't know.
Okay.
It seems weird that the exec would come in during service and, you know, but
So I don't know the hierarchy, but it's played by Joel McHale, and he comes in and just starts. It's almost like, you know what it reminds me of, even though like the demeanor is the exact opposite. It reminded me of the drill instructor from Full Metal Jacket, just comes in and just like straight for the jugular, berates him, puts him down, says he should be dead, but he's like whispering it in his ear basically as he's working, saying you're so slow,
just in the most calm possible like demeanor, just saying the most upsetting things you could possibly imagine, this like super quiet aggression.
Yes.
You know, like, and everyone in the kitchen is working, like, I wouldn't say silently, like there's communication going on, but like very quietly, very deliberately. Like, even when she brings the broken sauce, she brings the broken sauce up and he sees that it's broken and he's like, the sauce is broken, chef, please take it back and fix it. And then they actually show her going and trying to fix it. They show it broken. Actually, I'm like pretty amazed by the accuracy of a lot of the cooking shots and stuff in the show. Like,
oh, do they actually show the sauce? I don't remember that.
Yeah, they show like just in a couple like B-roll shots, like they show her walking away with it, but then they show her stirring a pot with a whisk and it's like this bright green sauce and you can tell that it's like, you know, split or whatever. And yeah, just like even little subtle details like that, it seems like somebody cares enough to try and get them right. But yeah, it was, that was horrifying. Like, it's like a complete contrast to the chaos of the kitchen, like in the sandwich shop in the first episode. But like, it's the same toxicity, you know, like it's like the same toxic hierarchical management and like the same
power tripping masculinity kind of stuff.
Exactly. And but just like with the volume turned down, it even seems more sinister. Like, it's it was so upsetting to watch. But yeah, it really seemed like 11 Madison Park is what they were trying to say there,
right?
Which I mean, I don't know enough about the culture of 11 Madison Park to know if that's an accurate observation or whatever, but
I only know what Daniel Hume has told me. So
yeah, exactly. But and it definitely seems like Daniel Hume, if like anything is sort of like, you know, a, you know, like trying to remedy that type of culture, but
right. Yeah. Yeah. But they do. So that scene, it does suggest that, that's the origin of a lot of his anxiety and stress. I think if I'm not 100% sure about this, but I think that even that line that, like, you should be dead or something like that. I think that he hears that in one of his stress dreams, or like it's,
yeah,
it's, he's somehow,
it's repeated.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, he has this flashback. Oh yeah. And then the other thing is that, the other thing that the other clue maybe to the idea that he was at 11 Madison Park is that Richie calls him 11 Madison Park in the first episode.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, he's like, whatever, Mr. 11 Madison Park or something like that. So, yeah, that's another little hint. I think they don't want to come out and say that that's where he was working necessarily.
Right.
They do name a bunch of places where he supposedly had worked.
He worked at the French Laundry and Noma.
French Laundry and
And I wanted to look into this, but I forgot before we started talking. The name of the restaurant that he won the Rising Star Chef of the Year.
Oh, yeah.
It was called Fairest Creatures in Malibu. And I wasn't sure if that was a real restaurant or not. It must
be. I'm not sure if it's real or not either. And I planned to. Okay. I'll look. Okay. Because I'm dying to know. That was like the first thing that I wanted to do as soon as I saw that on because it says that on his James Beard Award, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, what's that called again?
Fairest Creatures. That sounds more like a San Francisco restaurant to me than Malibu, but
I think it's fictional.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's interesting that there'd be so many real restaurants and then one, sorry, mentioned in the show and then one made up.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if like they plan on sort of like using it in the show or something down the line, you know? And so they wanted at least one restaurant, you know, that was fictional that they
could, not going to get sued by anyone by.
Yeah. Or that they wouldn't actually need to go and use the location of or something. You know? There is a Napa wine called Fairest Creature.
Okay.
But yeah, I'm not seeing any Fairest Creatures restaurant and nothing about that related to Malibu.
Okay.
So yeah, I guess guessing it's fictional. I don't know. Anyways, weird name for a restaurant.
Yeah, totally. The main arc for the second episode revolves around a health inspection.
Right. Yeah. Second episode is called Hands.
Right.
Which is a reference to like servers coming to pick up food to deliver it to customers. But yeah, basically. The opening is that, yeah, quiet aggression scene from theoretically 11 Madison Park, where he's working the pass. And then I think shortly after that, he has another stress dream where like he's alone in his apartment and he has a stress dream and he wakes up from the stress dream and something that he was cooking on the stove is like on fire and he has to put it out with a fire extinguisher.
If I remember right, he's cooking newspapers or something. Like he's... Am I crazy? Didn't he like put something in a pot that's not food?
I think it was packaged food, but he just like put the whole package in the pot or something. And there's like more than one of them or something. I don't know. It was really weird. And actually, yeah, I did find it very confusing. But then he talks about it with his sister later on in the episode and kind of explains what was happening. In fact, at the time, like when I first watched it, I just thought maybe the burning food in his apartment was a part of his stress dream.
That's what I thought at first too, yeah. But then he says, no, it happened.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So that was kind of weird. That part didn't really read right to me or something. But yeah, then he goes to the restaurant and the first kind of thing that happens is this, his new prospective sous chef, Sydney, approaches him and she has this like manifesto, basically like a bound booklet of like all of this research that she's done about the restaurant and all of these changes that she thinks that they could make to make the restaurant profitable. Just like this crazy, like, a booklet to basically like a manual basically for the entire restaurant. She's been there for a week and she hands him this manual and starts telling him about all of these things that she thinks that they could change, in order to, make the restaurant sustainable because it's clearly not sustaining itself. Like it's like practically out of business and in like the deepest possible amount of debt.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really cool. And like the stuff that she's talking about is all like, seemed like felt very real to me too. Like she's talking about ways that they can save on labor and all of right. these, you know,
changing like, the hours of operation and stuff like
yeah,
that.
Changing yeah. the hours of operation. And mm-hmm. that whole scene like played like, I don't know. It played very real to me. It played very realistically to me. Like
someone shows up with having a all of these,
yeah. I've been on both sides of that, you know, I've been mm-hmm. on both sides of that equation, and both sides, it's like, yeah, it feels very real. You know, like she's obviously very passionate about it. She's there for a reason. She wants to help as much as she can. She's like obviously a keener.
Mm-hmm.
And she hands him like all these really great actionable solutions and like, and, but he's just like, okay, but you know, like we can't do all of this all right now, all immediately, you know, like it's not as simple as just flipping a switch and we're going to save the restaurant, you know, like,
right.
And you can tell that he's like at one or like it felt to me. And I don't know if this is just like me reading into it because I've been in this situation, but like he was like on the one hand, like extremely impressed with her and thankful, but then also like totally exasperated because he's like, yeah, you know, like
right.
I can also see these things and you are correct and all of these things are great suggestions, but it's not as simple as just like flipping a switch and suddenly it's going to be like you have in your head, you know, like
mm-hmm.
we have to take these things one at a time and we have to take baby steps. You know, and then you can tell that she's a little bit frustrated by that because she sort of feels like he's being dismissive
yes.
of all of the work that she put in. And he's like a little bit frustrated because he's like, you know, like these are all great, but, you know, like we can't just flip all this all at once.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically like right after that, the health inspector shows up, I think. Yeah. And she's talking to Richie and Richie is being like, extremely, what's the word?
Belligerent.
Like, yeah, I would say that that's a better word than what I was thinking of. He's being extremely belligerent with her.
Mm-hmm.
He's, I guess, trying to avoid having her go into the kitchen to like do her health inspection or something.
He's asking like where the other guy is. The someone else used to do the inspections who he was probably really chummy
oh, right.
with. But that guy's not around anymore, so she's here, and she's not chummy with with Richie.
No.
Yeah.
And he's really digging his own grave by being a yeah. jerk to her,
yeah.
you know? And Carmine understands that, and he walks in, and he's basically like, you're here, you're the health inspector, do whatever you want, tell me whatever you need, I'm here to
yes.
help, you know, make your job as easy as it possibly can be.
Yeah.
And she does the inspection and she finds a few pretty blatant violations, which mm-hmm. a couple of I was kind of like, all right, is that really like something that a health inspector would like, you know, like call you out for? But yeah.
You mean the cigarettes on the stove? What do you mean?
Yeah, the cigarettes on the stove. I mean, not great. But like it's not during service, and I don't know, she's like claims that it's like a real health hazard to have to accidentally have left a pack of cigarettes like near the stove.
I thought it was weird, like she meant, my memory is that she mentioned with the cigarettes, she mentions first of all cross contamination, which I thought was silly. Like yeah, you shouldn't yeah. have cigarettes on the stove, but like how is it gonna anyways
yeah.
And the other one was
that's
that there was
really
a
thing.
Fire hazard, which also,
I mean, sort of, but there's like, you know, there's a paper towel dispenser right beside the stove or, you know, whatever, you know, like there's tons of paper, there's fire, you know, like,
yeah, it was a little odd. Like to me,
that one didn't seem like something that seems like the kind of thing where the health inspector would be like, you probably shouldn't have cigarettes like beside the stove. Like, and somebody would be like, oh my God, can't believe we left these there. Okay, well, sorry, or whatever, you know.
bit of a misunderstanding, and the health inspector would be like, yeah, okay, well, don't keep your cigarettes on the stove. I'd be like, yeah, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
But yeah, the other two things were what? No hot water in the hand washing station or something like that. And like, yeah. And a big hole in the wall that was like sealed shut with paper towel, which yeah, that's definitely something that a health inspector would see, mm-hmm. and would, you know, would be a serious violation, and that, you know, potentially they could, you know, ask you to stop serving food until you fixed it or something right. like that. So they get a C grade, which I guess I don't know how the grading system works. And I don't know if that's just in Illinois or what the situation is, but
it's the same I think in New York, and I think in places in California, I've seen it too. Like it's A, B, and C. And what's interesting to me is that they have to post it right at the entrance so that you can see it from the street. What do you think of that? it's so different. 'Cause here, like you post your, food handling certificate, permit. Like,
yeah.
Somewhere.
I mean, I think it's good. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, I think it's great. Like you should have to post your, food inspection rating, like on the front of your restaurant for customers to see. I don't love the idea of having, like, even with the food handling permit here in Canada, like, I don't love the idea of, like, I wish they would let you, like, they tell you that you're not supposed to frame it or anything, or that you're even not even allowed to frame it and stuff like that, mm-hmm. in Canada. You just have to have it like posted on your wall in a visible spot by the door where customers can see it or something like that. Mm-hmm. And you're not really allowed to like integrate it with the restaurant's decor, which I find somewhat annoying, but I do think it's important. And I think it's a good idea to post that type of information right where customers can see it. Mm-hmm. So I'm down.
Yeah.
Sucks if you get a C though.
Yes.
And you have to post it in your window. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's kind of like that's sort of like the arc of the episode, is they get this C and then they're kind of trying to fix the problems, but then also you know, that causes like a lot of additional stress for Carmi.
Mm-hmm. Isn't there, tell me if I'm remembering this right, like the entire health inspection storyline actually is part of Carmi's emotional arc, where they believe that the cigarettes were Richie's, but right at the end of the episode, so, don't they find out that it was their Carmi's cigarettes, and that's kind of what makes him decide to go to the Al-Anon meeting? Am I crazy?
I don't... Well, not sure about the very last thing you said about that's what makes him go to the Al-Anon meeting. Mm-hmm. There's some other things that happen in the episode where he calls his sister because he's got this like situation going on. He started a fire in his apartment. He's worried about his like mental health, I think, or worried about his anxiety or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so he contacts his sister, and she keeps saying, oh, did you check the thing? Did you look at the thing yet? And she's referring to something. And then eventually you find out the thing that she's referring to is she's been sending him information about Al-Anon, mm-hmm. And suggesting that he go check it out, mm-hmm. Which he hasn't done, and which he does do at the end of the episode. Or is it the very beginning of the next episode? Yeah, I can't remember. Anyways, yeah, I think he decides at the end of the episode, he looks at his phone and he sees the message about Al-Anon on his phone and kind of decides that he's going to go. But I don't necessarily know if that has to do with him realizing that the cigarette thing was his fault.
Mm-hmm. Really quickly, my interpretation of it was that, like, obviously at home he's having a tough time, and like you said, the fire in the apartment and everything, but it was like realizing that they were his cigarettes was like, he's like, oh, well, like work was supposed to be his sanctuary. Like he goes to work and he's in charge.
When he's at work, he's in control and everything. But then, like, now, you know, it's buttoned down.
It's gotten into his workplace. And so then as soon as he realized that the cigarettes were his, that's when he decided to go to the meeting. But
yeah. Right. which maybe that might be true. Yeah. Or at least it probably was a contributing factor. The cigarettes thing, though, I think is like, as much as like in the first episode, the like thing about him like getting the baker on his side or whatever was sort of like the kind of main arc, or like the main moment that made me really feel like, oh yeah, this feels very real, or something. Yeah, in the second episode, yeah, basically, so there's this thing, you know, like I think when, because the sous chef Sydney and Richie go to the store to buy caulk to fix the hole in the wall, and while they're doing that, they have some conversations, and I think he tells her that the cigarettes were his, or at least he mentions that to someone sometime during the episode. Right. Like Richie is definitely under the impression that he was the one that left the cigarettes by the stove.
And I'm
pretty sure like when they argue about it, when the health inspector is there, or like right after the health inspector, right after they get the C, they have a big argument, and I'm pretty sure Carmi, you know, blames Richie for the cigarette thing. And then later on, he goes outside, like right at the end of the episode, he goes outside to have a smoke. He realizes he doesn't have his cigarettes on him. Then he thinks back and he's like, oh, shit. Like, I'm the one that left the cigarettes by the stove or whatever. That to me was like sort of, I don't know, it was like kind of like the whole episode built up to that moment. And that moment to me was like so poignant, like as a, I mean, not just like because of the mental health things that are going on with him, but just like in terms of like being like a manager or a boss or a leader, and like trying to be certain about the things that you are like trying to get your team to do, or, you know, trying to be certain about the things that you're communicating with people. And then like, you know, at the end of the day, thinking back to something that you were sure that you were correct about, and then realizing that you were wrong about it.
Right.
And then just like feeling that like, oh, you know, like a little bit of regret, but also like, you know, I don't know, like realizing your fallibility and stuff. Like, I don't know, it felt like a really great moment, and it really made the episode for me.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah. So, yeah, that was episode two. We learned quite a bit about Sydney in that episode as well, but
Yes,
it was sort of like tied into Richie's sort of like story, and there's like some other threads that are like going through it too.
But yeah, you find out that the deceased brother Michael, I think, has been taking money from the mob, or like, sorry, has been borrowing like, money from the mob.
Yeah, seems like he has mob debt. Which that's that when that happened, I was like,
oh brother,
I can see why they put this in here, but it did feel a little over the top to me. Yeah. I was like, I mean, yes, could happen, but do we really need mob pressure in this story? Like,
but in defense of that elements, like, it wasn't like Fat Tony showed up at the door, like saying he was gonna break knees. It was like a really interesting character played by Oliver Platt. That was
apparently a friend of the family.
Yeah. And like, I thought it was actually an interesting conversation between the two of them, because
so did I.
It was ostensibly about debt, but you could tell that they had a history together, and it wasn't, it wasn't like a cartoonish Joe Pesci kind of situation.
Yeah, where somebody comes in to break Carmi's legs or something, or they come and take all the meat out of the fridge or something like that. You know, like it was, it was much more of like a conversation between two people that know each other, but you know. You know, with the end goal of making Carmi understand that, his brother owed a whole bunch of money to people who need to be paid back. Otherwise, bad things will happen. So
is Oliver Platt carving out a niche where he like is in food movies? Because he was the food critic in Chef. And so I wonder if he's like trying to angle himself like Stanley Tucci is, where he's like, I'm an actor, but like I'm really into food.
Yeah, I wonder. I wonder if he has a food book. We should.
Who doesn't have a food book, Shale? Name one human being who doesn't have a food book.
Just you can't, chill. You can't. I'm the only one who hasn't written a food book yet. Got to get on that. So yeah. Episode 2 ends with that really humbling realization that although he had like gotten mad at Richie about it, Carmine was the one who had left his cigarettes on the stove. Mm-hmm. So harsh. And then we're on to episode 3, which is called Brigade. Mm-hmm. And so it's about, I guess the arc of it is sort of like Carmi and, well, basically just Carmi decides that things will be better if they implement a brigade structure, and he kind of leaves Sydney in charge of making that happen. Mm-hmm. But it opens with an Al-Anon meeting.
Right.
And Carmi is just there observing, and there's a woman who's talking about her husband who is an addict, I guess. Mm-hmm. And she's just, giving her story about her feelings about that and how, you know, she feels like it's very difficult to understand what things you might do when you're like in a relationship or something with someone who has addiction problems, like what things you do are enabling them, and knowing that some of the things that you do are enabling them, but trying not to, and how like stressful that can be and that kind of stuff. And that's sort of like, I think they sort of like try to tie that into how Carmi goes and tries to organize the restaurant, which,
yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I think the kind of Carmi's takeaway from that woman's talk is that you have to recognize what you have control over, and then just take care of what you can control and forget about the rest, more or less.
Yeah. And so his solution to sort of like the disorganization at the restaurant is to just make sure that everyone understands what their task list is and they're responsible for those tasks, and there should be no problem, which doesn't turn out to work as easily as he thinks it will. But
great.
And then there's like a moment in near the beginning of the third episode where it's like during service again, and everyone's yelling, and they're in the front with customers preparing food, and they're all like yelling at each other in front of the customers. That also definitely, I mean, it was, I, like, you know, it could happen.
Yeah. Have you ever eaten at a Harvey's?
Still very over the top. Well, yeah. Yeah, exactly.
You reminded
but
me.
Yeah, like they don't have enough food for all the customers, and all the customers like waiting in a long line for their food, and they're all blaming each other for it, and everyone's like apologizing to the customers but then yelling at their coworkers, and
I mean
it's real, but again still sort of like felt kind of over the top and just like so crazy. It's not that hard to make some sandwiches. Why can't you guys just make a few sandwiches and hand them to the customers? I was just like, I was crawling out of my skin.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's clear that like the heart of the problem is that Richie feels like he's in charge and should be in charge, because he has kind of been in charge in a somewhat toxic and disorganized way. But, historically for past however many years the restaurant has been open, Richie's been there kind of running things with Michael, who's no longer around. Mm-hmm. And he just refuses to listen to Carmi, and Carmi refuses to listen to him. And, you know, nobody really feels like anyone's in charge, and everyone just feels like, you know, everything is all at sea. And in that scene, like up until then, most of the time, Sydney has been pretty calm, because she's like, it's okay, you know, like we're going to get through this rough patch. But even in that scene, you can tell that Sydney is like, this is crazy. Like something's got to give here.
Yes.
And so, yeah, I guess Carmi's idea is to like give everybody a brigade position, assign everyone like new tasks. Everyone sort of already has a station, but just like make clearer lines about who's responsible for what. Mm-hmm. And I guess he feels like he has a lot on his plate in terms of figuring out the, like, the financial management of the business. And so he kind of hands off the kitchen operations and the brigade system to Sydney, mm-hmm. Who seems very reluctant to take on that task. I think that she doesn't agree with him that a brigade system is the right way to go. Like, she thinks that there's a better way to organize everyone without creating a hierarchy, which the people are probably not going to feel like is fair since they've been working there for such a long time. And
right.
Carmi and Sydney are just brand new. And so, you know, who are they to come in and tell everybody what their job is or something?
Mm-hmm.
Which is basically what happens. And then Carmi, like near the beginning of the day, I guess, kind of has a panic attack and runs off to go to another Al-Anon meeting, which you don't see, I don't think. You just see him going there, but you don't actually see what happens in that meeting.
Mm-hmm.
But then a large chunk of the episode is just Sydney trying to sort of like herd the cats that are the kitchen team.
Yes.
And there's a lot of like she's walking around trying to get people organized, and she's having some success with some of the crew. But then there is some of the crew who really don't want to listen to her. And one woman in particular, Tina, I think is her name, who's like straight up like sabotaging things behind her back.
Yes.
And stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which, yeah. I mean, could happen.
I was gonna say, is that a thing? Because it's kind of like an element of a lot of, or an element of some food and cooking shows and movies. Like it's one of the important parts of that movie Burnt that we talked about briefly, the Bradley Cooper one. This idea that,
and
like,
there's similar stories in like Kitchen Confidential and right. stuff like that about sabotage, and there are similar stories in other like narratives about fine dining restaurants that I've read and things mm-hmm. like that. Like, I mean, yeah, I'm sure it exists. It seems so horribly like mustache twirlingly evil to me. Like, I don't think I've ever worked in a kitchen where anyone would like deliberately sabotage anyone like that. Like, maybe so in the very first episode, someone takes Carmi's knife and hides it, like puts it on the floor underneath the stove.
Right. Yeah.
Okay. That maybe, but like ruining the food. I don't know, like, because yeah, that Tina woman like turns the stock pot on full blast
right.
to like ruin the stock, and yeah, it just like, I don't know, it really first of all, it caused me a lot of anxiety. It really got under my skin, and at the same time I was like, really, would she really do that? Like, what's the end result of that? They have a bad service, like you know, like, it just seems, I don't know, it seems dumb, but
yeah. I mean, obviously,
I didn't love the sabotage part,
right? It whether or not it's realistic, like, it just speaks to how petty and juvenile the attitudes
the staff
are.
There yeah. is, yeah. yeah, 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 and that's real. You know, like, yeah. I mean, they need a way to demonstrate that,
right.
and they need a way to demonstrate like how bad it actually is.
Yeah.
And that definitely makes it seem really bad. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
And so what's the arc of this episode?
I guess the arc is that, I mean, I think what the episode is trying to say is that you need a way to be able to communicate.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe in some instances, like, a hierarchical organization makes it a very simple, like, straightforward. Like, in a hierarchy, you know who you need to communicate with,
mm-hmm.
right? But, like, the sort of, like, Carmi and Sydney are kind of on opposite sort of like perspectives when it comes to what they think the best way to get that layer of communication going is. Mm-hmm. And I think the arc is that, you know, Carmi thinks that, you know, the brigade is the way to do it because that is what he's been doing and what he's been used to. Mm-hmm. And I think that Sydney is kind of like over that. And that's probably part of the reason why she's not working in those fine dining restaurants anymore. Mm-hmm. And she kind of gives a reason for why she isn't doing that anymore at the end of the episode. And it's sort of that, you know, she feels like in those places, it's really hard for her to make a mark or do something that's like worthwhile.
Right.
You know, like she's not in charge of any of the dishes. She doesn't, you know, like she's just there perfecting someone else's, you know, idea.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, she thinks that it doesn't have to be so structured and it doesn't have to be so like hierarchical or whatever. Actually, she has like a kind of a funny line when they're talking about it in the office at the beginning, when he sort of like lays it out for her. He's like, oh, well, like we should have a brigade. And she's like, I was thinking more like something like a chillarchy rather than a hierarchy. I was like, yeah, that's pretty hilarious. but it's true. Like not everything I think has to be that structured. And I think her idea is that it's going to be better if everyone just communicates with each other rather than, you know, trying to structure everything so that nobody has to communicate with each other.
Yeah. Especially for such and a small I think that's team. Yeah.
And I think that's the arc of the episode because like, it, you know, like basically by the end of it, she says to Carmi that she doesn't really feel like he's listening to her and that if they want to do something good together, that they need to listen to each other to be able to cooperate. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of like that's the crux of what it comes to by the end of the episode. Mm-hmm. Man, there's some heartbreaking moments though. Like, I don't know who put a 20-liter Cambro of stock on the top shelf on the top of a cardboard box of what looks like bacon or something. But man, like this is the worst possible place to put a Cambro of stock. And Sydney tries to get it down and, you know, drops it all over the floor.
Did that give
after
you
refusing
flashbacks?
Someone's help?
Yeah, that's
what's
true.
That?
Did that?
Oh
did
my
that
God. Yeah, it gave me so many flashbacks. It was the worst. Just watching her drop that whole container of stock on the floor, I was just like, yep, it's the worst. What I thought was nice, though, is that like she refused someone's help because, you know, she was feeling frustrated. And then like 30 seconds later, she's like got stock all over herself and all over the floor. But immediately that same guy who I think was the baker. Is that right?
I think so. Yeah,
I think so. Yeah. He comes in even though she refused his help. He just comes in like and helps her clean it up like,
yes,
wordlessly. Just, yeah, you know, which I thought was really cool. It was a nice. It's a nice real kitchen moment, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. Like just like something bad happens. Okay. Like, let's just stop what we're doing and we'll fix this problem. And then we'll get back to what we were doing.
Right. Yeah.
Even if what we were doing was kind of being at each other's throats or something. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Yeah. But yeah, I really liked the third episode and it really made me want to keep watching, but I didn't keep watching because then I thought if I watched more than you did that I would like accidentally reveal something while we were talking about it.
Oh, so. Because you have FX?
So yeah, or I Hula? Have, what's that?
Or Hula or something?
I don't have whatever streaming service they are on, but I have access to the rest of the episodes. Let's say they fell off the back of a truck. Okay. I don't know.
Were you familiar with the Chicago Italian beef sandwich scene before this?
No, I don't think so.
Having recently traveled to Chicago.
Yeah, I know. I'm a bad Chicago traveler.
I didn't really know.
All I did was go to fancy places when I was in Chicago. Exactly. So, is it a thing?
Yeah, it's a thing. I think, yeah, they just call them Italian beef sandwiches, but it's like shaved roast beef with jus on a crusty roll or a crust, like a French kind of, I don't know what they call it there, but like, it looks like a mini baguette kind of, and then I think you can get it with like Chicago style, what's the mix that the jardiniera or whatever, do you know what I mean? Like the spicy pickles.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I didn't know that was a thing.
Right. But... Oh, that's what they're calling peppers all the time, probably, right?
Well,
when
okay,
they're calling out orders.
This is just straight from Wikipedia, so don't think that I know what I'm talking about. The Italian beef, usually you either get it sweet, which is with like sauteed peppers, like green peppers, get it hot, and that's with the jardiniera, which in Chicago, apparently, jardiniera is usually spicy.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Sounds good, though.
Yeah, should have had one while I was there.
That's what, and I really like the actual name of the sandwich shop. It's just called the Original Beef of Chicagoland, which I think is fantastic. It's just like,
it's great.
It's the name of a restaurant that's been around for 75 years, kind of
forever. Thing. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, they nailed that for sure. Another weird thing about the show that like we didn't talk about at all because it's just sort of like this weird kind of like tacked on thing. But Maddie Matheson is like a character in the show, which is like really weird.
I was trying to think about this before we talked. Like, he doesn't work there, right? Is he a vendor or something? He's just always around, but he doesn't work there.
Yeah, but I got the impression when the health inspector was there, they were having a conversation and he was involved and it made it seem like he was kind of like a part of the team, but he's not one of the cooks. Mm-hmm. So, in the first episode, he's like repairing some of the equipment.
Right.
And so, yeah, I'm not quite sure why he's there or what the situation is. And he seems to have like I think he had one line in the first episode and a couple lines in the second episode. And I don't remember if I saw him in the third episode or not.
Yeah, I don't know.
But yeah, kind of interesting. He's not really an actor. He doesn't really come across he's definitely a character. And I guess if he can play himself, then maybe it'll work out. But I don't know. It seemed kind of weird that he just sort of like showed up in the show. And I was like, okay, that's interesting.
I don't know.
Like friend of the director? I don't know.
Well, he's like, I don't know. They needed like a Joey Tribbiani kind of like kooky character kind of element to it, like to make it a little bit, take some of the heat off. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. Yeah, I guess he's like a little bit comic relief.
Yeah.
But it's just, I think it's weird that, you know, because like, you know, he's not an actor and he's not a comedian. Yeah. So it just like sort of, I don't know, it sort of seemed like a novelty to have him in there. But
so, okay. I don't know if this is related at all. But like someone who's kind of part of the food world who showed up in a movie and I was like, what? In The Irishman, at the end, Action Bronson sells Robert De Niro his casket. Do you remember that?
No, I don't. And I've only seen The Irishman once. And there's a lot of movie there to remember. Yes. So, yeah, no, I don't remember that. But
that was
that's interesting.
A lot of interesting casting that worked really well. Like Ray Romano surprised me. Like is so great in that movie. But then, Action Bronson just sneaks in right at the end. I'm like, what? Why is this guy in a Scorsese's
movie? How did this happen? And I guess it's probably because he's from New York and he probably runs into Scorsese or something. Yeah,
place. I don't know.
Yeah, that's how I feel. Yeah, this is exactly how I feel about it. I feel like Maddie Matheson must be like friends with the show's creator or something. And maybe like the show's creator must have experience in restaurants. Like it can't just be a consult. Like I can't, because he's like, he wrote and directed the first two episodes and he's written all three of the episodes that I've watched. And so like, you know, like if he's writing them and relying on a consultant to like inject the restaurant part of it, like that doesn't seem realistic to me.
Right.
Like he must have some pretty deep experience in restaurants to be able to write the episodes in as realistic a way. Like not everything is like totally realistic, and I definitely feel like there are certain things that are sensationalized, but like just like the level of realism that is there, I think is like it would be impossible to write that without having direct experience with it.
Right.
So, and like even with the fine dining aspect of it too, so I imagine but yeah, anyway, what do you think, Alan? Recommend? Are you gonna watch the rest of it?
Yeah, I will when I have access to it. Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. I'm pretty eager to watch the rest of it. Like a lot of shows, I just like fall off of them. And I had been meaning to sort of like start watching this for a few weeks. I heard about it like maybe 3 weeks or a month ago or something. Mm-hmm. And then I was kind of like, oh yeah, I should check it out. But it's like, I don't know. It's surprisingly hard to convince me to watch a new show.
Right.
I think the fact that the episodes were, well, no, I guess I didn't know that the episodes were half an hour until after I watched the first one. So that wasn't really a contributing factor, but that definitely helped. Once I realized that they were like half hour episodes, I was like, oh, this seems like pretty. And yeah, like for a show with like half hour episodes, the arc of each episode so far has been like surprisingly
tight, yeah,
satisfying, mm-hmm. I would say. So yeah, I'm eager to watch the rest of it. I think, I don't know if it's the entire season is out yet, but there are 8 episodes that are currently released. Okay. So, yeah. And I could give them to you on a flash drive if you want.
Cool. Okay.
Word.
Do you ever taste something and go, that's fire? Have you ever said that?
No.
No.
But I understand what it means, and I've heard it said a lot. And yeah. I may have said it ironically a couple times, but
that's something that my students say a lot.
All the time. They're like, oh yeah,
that's fire.
That spaghetti and meatballs is fire.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like the high.
I mean, I kind of like it.
Oh, you know, I like it too. Does seem like the highest compliment that they pay to each other in terms of food. Sorry, in terms of commenting on each other's food.
Right.
Yeah.
Why do you bring it up?
Because they say it like, like if you made the bear drinking game, every time they say that's fire, you have to have a drink. Fire.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Fair. Yeah, I guess, I don't know, maybe I'm surrounded by it so much that it just doesn't even sink in for me now or something.
I've never said it, but I'm going to start saying it, and I'm going to, just so that like I'm cool.
For
and
sure.
And so the first time I say it, I'll say it, and then I'll look around at all the students and make sure it landed, and then I'll be like, okay, I did it.
That's right. That's how you make it extra cool, is by looking around to make sure that
like, that's fire. Did I do it right?
Exactly. Yeah. Anyways, listeners, this show is fire. You should check it out.
And scene.
Thanks for listening to Food Court, a podcast recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Food Court is hosted by Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan and Shale McDonald. Make sure to subscribe to Food Court in Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or in your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from our listeners. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram at Food Court Podcast. If you want to spread the word, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.